The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
First, we are going to cross to the US, where our reporter Hannah McCarthy was at the Trump rally in Atlanta last night and was speaking to some of those attending.
He's still standing. He's still in the race. No matter what they say, all the lies they say, all the stupid misdemeanor felonies that get thrown out, dismissed and thrown out, he's still in it. He's here for us.
Do you feel even more kind of motivated to come out and campaign for him and to attend these events since the assassination attempt?
Yes. Very much so, because that means that they're threatened by him. If it was a plot, I don't know if it was a plot. It could have been just some dumb guy who got what he deserved. But if it was a plot, that means he's a threat.
So you've been to a couple of Trump rallies. How did today's one compare with the ones you saw before?
It was really enjoyable. Like, it was one of the bigger ones, which before I had been to several smaller rallies. Like, to me, it seems like Trump is kind of learning some things from his presidency and how he presents himself. Like, he's still Trump. I mean, you're either going to like his speeches or you're not. I joke, it's like ribeye steak. Like, you either like it or you don't. But I do think that certain things, I mean, like, you know, like the man or hate the man, he did nearly lose his life 3 weeks ago. Like, I think that has had an effect on him. Like, I've noticed it. A lot of people close to Trump have noticed it. But in terms of, like, the actual policy and talking points, I think it's similar to who he was in 2016, but a bit more refined. If the Democrats win a good, clean campaign, I'll recognize it in a heartbeat, because that's the right thing to do. We can live in a democratic society. However, if it's like there's a lot of fraud or something, and again, allegations are allegations, I mean, provable fraud, then, you know, I would look at it and keep it up in my own mind. But I respect the rule of law, and I respect the democratic process.
Isn't it interesting how the theory or the plot that something is going on behind the scenes, be it the assassination attempt or maybe rigging the election, it's always there, not very far from the surface, it seems, with the Republicans. Those people speaking to our reporter Hannah McCarthy at the Trump rally in Atlanta last night. And we are going to pick up on that idea of conspiracy theories now, because there was some interesting research from the Electoral Commission this week. They did a whole battery of research into the local and European elections, and including a very big Red Sea poll. It had about 3,000 respondees, which is about three times the size of your normal opinion poll that you might see in some of the papers today. So it's quite in depth and goes into a number of different areas. You know, one of the questions being, there's a small secret group of people responsible for making all the major decisions in the world. 30% of Irish people believe that, according to this particular poll. One in three elected officials want more immigration to bring in obedient voters who will vote for them. 22% believe in that. Experiments involving new drugs or technologies are routinely carried out on the public without their knowledge or consent. Again, 22% of people believing in that. So what's behind this engagement and belief in conspiracy theories? And was it always there and it's just more visible now, or is it something that's new? Well, joining me to discuss this is David Robert Grimes, scientist and author of The Irrational Ape: Why We Fall for Disinformation, Conspiracy Theory and Propaganda. David, good morning and thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Sean. Thanks for having me.
So the first thing that struck out to me about that information was the volume of people. I mean, I think we all kind of know when people do engage with conspiracy theories and some people believe them, but I thought it was much smaller than the sort of one in five or one in three that we're seeing there. You're more of an expert in this field. Did it surprise you?
It didn't particularly surprise me, no. So even before the pandemic and back in 2016, when this was last kind of polled around Europe, about a quarter of the population are highly susceptible to what's called conspiratorial ideation. That is the tendency to explain events by invoking conspiracies, even when more mundane explanations are far more likely. The kind of people that reach to conspiracies as an explainer. And because it's about a quarter of a population, and roughly those numbers stack, that does seem to be consistent, but social media has definitely exacerbated it to a huge degree.
Has COVID also made it worse?
Absolutely. I mean, look, when we were all in lockdown and the world was hit by the first major pandemic of a digital era, we now have technology to instantaneously share our opinions and to share gossip. And because we had nothing better to do, we were all stuck in, we were online all the time, people percolated to that environment. And when they fell into that ecosystem, and we do know that conspiracy theories online have ecosystems, you become more and more polarized and more radicalized away from conventional news sources that will actually do fact-checking. And for that reason, people that were susceptible who fell into those bubbles are far more difficult to rescue from those bubbles.
And when you say that 25% of people are susceptible or maybe vulnerable to this sort of ideology, do we know, like, is there a set cohort of people who tend to be more likely to fall into that group, or is it quite diverse?
It's quite diverse, but there's certain traits that make people more susceptible, and they're all quite different. There's one thing about, for example, some people have an aversion to randomness. They are very uncomfortable with the idea that things can just happen. They seem to insist on finding random patterns because to them that gives them what's called epistemic certainty. It's an illusion of understanding. It's entirely illusory, but it gives them a sense of control. It's, of course, not real control. It's quite damaging. It's misleading. But for some people, that's a big thing. Other people have a poor grasp of cause and effect. They assume that something followed something else, therefore it must have caused it. And for some people, about a third of the more vocal conspiracy theorists, I should also point out, conspiracy theorists are on a spectrum. They go from people who are, you know, very into it to who are just sympathetic to it. The ones who are very into it and tend to propagate it usually are more egotistical and more narcissistic than the average bear. And the reason for that is because it gives them a sense of superiority and it feeds into ego as well. You'll often see people that will propagate conspiracy theories are often incredibly arrogant about their ability and their understanding, even when they objectively demonstrate that they have very poor understanding.
Well, that was something I wanted to explore with you, because I think we've all at some point engaged in conspiracy theories. I'm thinking of JFK assassination, for example, where libraries full of books have been written about it. And that takes in all sorts of people, not just maybe people who are of a particular mind. So where does it go from something like that, that maybe at a historical remove is a bit more okay to speculate on, to then getting into more dangerous conspiracy theories?
Well, it's actually interesting. You hit on something there that I think people often miss, right? There's been dozens of books about JFK claiming, you know, different people did him in. And actually, I think I've been writing about this recently. There's 270 different people or organizations that have been blamed for JFK assassination. But if you look at the academic research on it, like, or even the big books like Gerd Posner's Case Closed, like, academically, it was always Lee Harvey Oswald and no one else. And he was always going to do it if you understand Lee Harvey Oswald. But that's the thing. No one wants to read the academic, you know, systematic reviews that go through all the evidence and that kind of painstaking detail. It's much more exciting to believe that there was some sinister plot. The other thing that is very relative here is proportionality bias. JFK's assassination was absolutely massive, and people assume that big events must have big causes. Some amino like Lee Harvey Oswald could kill a giant like JFK. It doesn't feel right to us. So it has to be made bigger. COVID-19 starting from random mutations of an existing bat coronavirus doesn't sound convincing. It's what most likely happened, but it doesn't give us a narrative sweep that we crave. So there's a tendency of humans to put narrative sweeps on things that are often just very random. And that can be more harmful or less harmful depending on the situation. We're seeing right now with all the riots that are happening around Ireland and England, led by racist agitators online spreading disinformation about immigrants and about different things like that, how damaging that can be. So the JFK thing is historical. People can speculate. They're wrong, but they can speculate. It's much more dangerous when it's contemporaneous and that it can cause harm right now.
Well, the immigration one, like you say, is a very hot button topic at the minute. And in this research from the Electoral Commission, 22% of people believe the establishment is replacing Irish white people with non-white immigrants. Another 22% of people believe the government wants immigration to bring in obedient voters who will vote for them. This is sort of a version of the great replacement theory that we've seen before in the US. You might just explain to us, where did that theory come from, and why is it gaining more traction here in Ireland, do you think?
The great replacement narrative actually started in France years ago with an academic writer, but was adopted by the American hard right. And this is the idea, as you just said there, that some sinister government cabal or international government cabals have decided to replace white Europeans with people of color. Now, the big question is, why would they do that? Which is never answered in this thing. And how would they get away with it? It's never answered. What this is essentially is a form of racial panic. And it plays into the hands of racist demagogues who can then justify their pretty, you know, awful actions by just claiming, oh, we're doing this too. This is about conspiracy theories, by the way. You often notice people that believe in conspiracy theories will always reframe themselves as the good guy, as the noble few standing up against the, you know, the evil them. So this is how they can justify being incredibly racist and horrible. They can try to claim that they're doing it from a point of moral good. So they have to create that narrative to basically cover up for the fact that what they're doing is objectively awful. The only way they can justify that, and conspiracy theories are about never having to say you're sorry, they can still say that they are somehow morally virtuous, even though they are contemptible.
And again, do they come, is the key to a good conspiracy theory or getting someone to believe a good conspiracy theory is wrapping it up in a kernel of truth? Because if you look at, again, the research that the Commission has done, 59% of people agree that the government keeps many important secrets from the public, including government party voters, according to this. It's very easy for someone to believe that. Is that almost like a gateway drug to then more wacky conspiracy theories?
To be fair, governments do keep things from people. I mean, there's internal civil service reports and things like that that are done. So, you've got to be careful of the polling information there as well. Because if you ask me, do governments keep information from people? Yes. The governments often have to. or it's internal research that they do for themselves. That can mean a very different thing. So people can take that kernel of truth and absolutely distort it. For example, a Garda Síochána operation to detect organized crime won't be given to the public until it's successful. But it's not a conspiracy. People tend to conflate the fact that just because you're not getting it, there's things that the public are interested in versus public interest, and they're not always the same thing. But yes, there's an element of truth to it as well, but there's often an element of narrative reframing so people can make themselves feel like they're the hero in a story, no matter what role they're playing.
Electorally, how big a problem is it? Because if you go down to the sweep of history, people almost never trust government. It's far more likely that people aren't going to trust the government. So is this something that we should be unduly worried about that has gotten worse? Or is it something that's always been there and it's just more visible now because we can all see a tweet where we wouldn't have heard some theory someone would whisper to someone in the back of a pub before?
So this has always been a problem. And I wrote about it extensively in the book, the whole history of this being a problem. Why it is more dangerous a problem now is, as you point out, the immediacy. Years ago, if I was spreading a rumor or if I wanted to spread, you know, disinformation about someone, it required a lot of physical effort. And I could do it only on a relatively limited range. And even then, historically, that caused problems. Now, I can put out a tweet or I can put a post on social media with no verification that can literally cause riots. I mean, what we're seeing happening in the UK at the moment, and we saw happening in Dublin back in November, was largely spurred by racist agitators using conspiracy theories to rile people up over a tragedy that had occurred that had nothing to do with the thing they framed it around. Because you can marshal people that much quicker, because you can spread disinformation that much further with that much less effort, the fundamental cognitive flaws in humans that predispose us to conspiracy theories haven't changed. But our lack of media literacy, particularly in the digital era, and the ability of bad actors to reach much further means that if you look this as a viral disinformation, I think it's well named because it does infect people, they can infect much further than they used to.
So how do you tackle that? Because there'll be people listening here who won't believe me or you because I'm a member of the media and you're an academic, but might go on to Facebook or Twitter or whatever and believe something that they see posted by, it could be an anonymous account, it could be someone who has no expertise in the area. How do you tackle something like that?
With great difficulty, and a lot of it is about understanding our own cognitive biases. As I said earlier on, conspiracy theories exist on a spectrum, and the amount that we subscribe to them is also on that spectrum. They are much easier to prevent than reverse. And I often say, and I say this in the book, and I say this when I give talks to the public, dialogue is more important than debate. Social media is always about debating and arguing and winning, right? But if you have someone that's expressing conspiratorial views, and they're not all the way down the rabbit hole, one of the questions I'll often ask is, that's really interesting. Why do you believe that? Like, where did you get that information from? And then I would ask, okay, what could I tell you that would change your mind? And if they say, well, this information would change my mind, or if they say nothing would change my mind, I go, well, there's no point us having this conversation. But the big things societally we can do is improving media literacy, improving critical thinking, and realizing that if you see it online or even gossiped, it's almost certain to be false, out of context, or exaggerated. And instead, we don't have that criticality. So it already has infected us, and then we're trying to cure it rather than prevent it. That's no good on a societal level. It's way more effort to reverse a bad idea than it is to prevent it in the first place.
So if you see a friend or a family member who's gone down this rabbit hole, who maybe was isolated during COVID, who has started to believe some of it but hasn't totally jumped the shark yet, how do you approach them?
I mean, I try to be as non-judgmental as possible in conversation. Don't do it online, by the way. Don't do it on Facebook or Twitter. You might win in front of your mates, but you're going to drive them further down it. If it's a family member or friend, I just go, that's interesting. Why do you believe that? And where did you hear that from? And was it verified? What you're doing is sowing the seeds for them to ask themselves the own question. You're giving them an alternative explanation than the stuff they've heard. But you have to let people sit with that. Very few people just suddenly go, oh, I was absolutely wrong. We need time. We're humans. We're egotistical. We're insecure in our ideas. If someone just goes, you're an idiot, that's probably not going to change their mind. But if you send them away with an alternative and plant the seeds of doubt in their conspiracy theory and give them an alternative, which is much more believable, you might actually win more converts that way. Mm. But you have to pick your battles.
Yeah, a very sensible approach and probably one that social media doesn't lend itself to. David Robert Grimes, thanks a million for joining us on the Anton Savage Show this morning. And you can get his book, The Irrational Ape, Why We Fall for Disinformation, Conspiracy Theory and Propaganda. A very good read, a very interesting read as well. Going into some of the examples down through history where critical thinking has saved us literally from world disaster.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.